Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up in just a moment, reading the Bible in our digitalized world. The abbot of St. Paul Outside the Walls tells us more. A day of prayer and reflection on the dignity of human life. We travel to the southern US city of Huntsville, Texas, and looking beyond the economic crisis to the message of hope at the heart of this Advent season. Here in Rome on Thursday, biblical scholars and computer experts are teaming up for a conference on the theme Reading the Bible Today in Our Digitalized World. The conference at St. Paul Outside the Walls will follow up on the theme of the recent Synod of Bishops, stressing the importance of making the Word of God more easily available and more relevant to people of all ages and of all nationalities.
This whole process of looking at the way in which the Bible, the Word of God, has been concretely transmitted across the centuries is part of what we're interested in.
The abbot of St. Paul Outside the Walls is Father Edmund Power. He told me more about how the idea for this conference first came about.
I think the project began when the two gentlemen Italians who run the non-profit making organisation or called Digital Codices, or Digitalizing Codices. They're quite clued up on computer technology and so on, and are also very interested in the preservation and in the transmission of ancient texts from a monastic context, but or maybe from other contexts as well. And some of their work, which is very well done, with their work, they became quite interested in sharing what they're doing. And so that there was a similar symposium a year or so ago held at the Abbey of St. Cecilia here in Rome, of the Benedictine nuns, which reflected on a similar question. And after that, they were quite keen to collaborate also with the monks of St. Paul's here. So we agreed that we'd jointly host or organise this symposium. Each speaker will give a short input of maybe 20 minutes, half an hour maximum, with some discussion afterwards. It's not a kind of Lectio Divina or spiritual reading of the Bible. It's not a morning of retreat or reflection. It's not a meditation. It's more looking at the techniques of writing Bibles, of presenting Bibles, of communicating the Word of God. In other words, I suppose it's a kind of spiritual cultural thing. So people coming who expect to have their lives transformed by the power of the Word of God, this is a sort of preliminary step. That will come later, maybe.
It does seem to follow up, though, from the recent Synod of Bishops looking at the way the Word of God should be made more available to people to be able to transform their lives. It's very significant also because you have some very ancient texts here, don't you, at St. Paul's?
Yeah, we do. Like many monasteries, in particular the more ancient monasteries, monasteries are long-term institutions with a certain stability about them. And also they're often cultural institutions with a very long history, often embedded or rooted in the country or region in which they're situated. And often they're the source of the life of that region. We are here in Rome, so Rome has a great richness already, but the Abbey of St. Paul's has been here for a very long time, and the Benedictines are here probably at least from the year 730 AD, 1300 years. So over that very long period, we've gathered a lot of archives. Not all the archives have survived, of course. I mean, that there have been periodic despoliations of archives, for example. The Napoleonic occupation of Rome at the beginning of the 19th century, a whole lot of stuff was carted off to Paris. Not all of it came back. Some of it was probably lost on the way, you know. These mule caravans moving up the Via Flaminia, laden with ancient manuscripts from the abbeys. And then the mules being too heavily burdened, so the manuscripts being carted off or ditched. So you've got these images of the difficulties of history. But Now we've got quite a very rich archive, in fact, with a whole lot of stuff, even stuff that's not directly associated with us, because other documents have found their way here for preservation. Among the documents or the objects that are the most precious for us is the so-called Carolingian Bible, which is very well known, which we've had from the 9th century, the monastic community of St. Paul's. It was a gift, not from Charlemagne, Charles the Great, but from his son, to the Pope, who I think the Pope Adrian at the time. It was written or illuminated in France, maybe in Reims, and it was given to the Pope as a gift, and the Pope passed it on to the monks of St. Paul's, and we've had it ever since. Now, this Bible is perhaps a symbol of your basic question, because you mentioned the Synod of Bishops, which was concerned with the Word of God, but it was concerned with the Word of God as a living force, as something proclaimed, meditated, lived. It wasn't concerned directly with the question of how that word is proclaimed, how that word is written, how that word is translated. And we know that very well that we would normally treat a Bible with veneration, the physical object of a Bible. It's not just any old selection of sheets, because the Word of God is in fact sacramentalized or made concrete in the printed or handwritten word. So this whole process of looking at the way in which the Bible, the Word of God, has been concretely transmitted across the centuries is part of what we're interested in, which brings us back to the Carolingian Bible. It's an exquisite and wonderful piece of work. Who knows how many years it took to write? It's all written by hand. Each page is a sheet of sheepskin dried and stretched. Now, for us, for the monks of St. Paul's, this is not just part of the family silver. It's not part of our heritage in that sense. It's a sacramental for us. Or, put in another way, it's an icon. It was created in a context of meditation and prayer, like an icon is. And it's been for us the sacramentalization of our fundamental commitment to the Word of God. So for us, it's not just a museum object. It's not a museum object, in fact. It's an object of profound veneration. So you can see how this sort of mentality, in fact, informed the whole process of the monastic life and the monastic civilization across the centuries since St. Benedict died in the 6th century, saving civilization in the Dark Ages, etc., with his rule, but how the monks have committed themselves to this incarnational work of actually seeking to express the divine, not just in a theoretical or a spiritualized way, but through their work. And their work wasn't just economics, digging, agriculture. Those are all very important, and the monks had a lot to do with the development of that form of work. But also on the cultural level, art, music, and so on. So, you know, the process of transmitting the word in the scriptoria of the monasteries was essential, bringing us right down to the modern age of computers. Now, I don't know if monks are at the forefront, they're probably not at the forefront of computing nowadays, because it's a very different art form. And in fact, education, culture is not anymore restricted to certain contexts. It's open to all people. But we've got nowadays the opportunity, let's say, as well as the challenge of how to use the constantly changing modern technology to do what maybe the monks used to do with the work of their hands. So that the question of reading the Bible today, it's, I suppose, the context of this symposium is more the kind of the hardware rather than the software of the process. You could say that the Synod was dealing with the software of transmitting the Word of God. We're kind of looking a little bit at the hardware, which underlies the software.
My thanks there to the abbot of the Benedictine Abbey of St. Paul outside the walls here in Rome, Father Edmund Power. Advent is a season of hope for the Church and for all of humanity. Those were Pope Benedict's words as he celebrated the first Vespers of Advent in St. Peter's Basilica last weekend. And that same theme is also at the heart of a pastoral letter for Advent written by the Bishop of Nottingham in England to Catholics in his diocese, many of whom, he notes, are not feeling very hopeful as they struggle to cope with the current economic downturn.
The economic crisis is affecting our people in many, many ways. Above all, unemployment is a big threat.
In his pastoral letter for Advent, Bishop Malcolm McMahon quotes from St. Paul's words of encouragement to the Christians at Philippi, noting that Paul himself wrote the letter while suffering in prison. The bishop urges people to look beyond their present difficulties and focus on the message at the heart of our Christian faith. Bishop McMahon, can you tell us first of all how the current economic crisis is really affecting your area?
Yes, Philippa. We were a mining area. Nottinghamshire and Derbyshire and parts of Leicestershire even were very much mining communities, and the mines closed 20 years ago. And some of those areas have not recovered fully economically. Attempts at regeneration have failed. And now people are faced with more cuts, with possibility of unemployment, possibility of losing their homes. Because many people started to buy their homes when they got their payoffs from the coal board or from their previous industry. Now, of course, they can't afford the mortgages. So the threats are very real here in Nottinghamshire and Derbyshire, Leicestershire.
Have you got very many people facing serious chronic situations of poverty, people risking sleeping out on the streets and so on?
That's handled rather well in our area. The Catholic charities, particularly the Catholic charities, have responded well to looking after people who are homeless. We have one in Nottingham and also another one in Derbyshire, which was the one in Nottingham's Emmanuel House. It was set up by the diocese and the Assumptionist Fathers, and that continues for over 20 years to do great work for the people. And similarly, in Derbyshire, the Sisters of Mercy set up a charity, which is now a major one, which runs centres for the homeless. So we do cope with that very well, I think. But the prospect for people losing their homes and individuals, particularly young people, finding they've got nowhere to sleep at night, nowhere to live, is becoming an increasing problem.
How is this crisis affecting the Church, do you think? I mean, have you noticed people turning increasingly to their faith in such times of hardship, or are they actually staying away because there's so much else on their minds at the moment?
I think our church attendance is holding up very well. But what we notice with our city centre church is that people of other Christian denominations and other faiths are using those churches during the day for quiet, for prayer, for meditation, to give them a place of, give them a space where they can talk to God and to their gods as well. So we have Hindus and Muslims, all sorts coming in. It's really quite remarkable.
What are relations like between the different churches, the different faiths, indeed, there in your part of the country? There are big communities, as you say, Hindu and Muslim communities, aren't there?
Oh, yes, Leicester is always quoted as being the first majority Asian city. Just over 50% of the inhabitants would have come from the Indian subcontinent, from the Philippines, and also from parts of Africa as well. So it's a very multiracial, multi-ethnic, multicultural community. But we don't have too many, inter-community difficulties, because Leicester is still, in the south of the diocese, is still a fairly prosperous town, a commercial town with small industries. And so while people are working and they're enjoying some prosperity, the racial tensions recede into the background.
And what is the morale or the atmosphere like within your own church? You were quoted recently in the secular press, weren't you, as suggesting the church should accept more married men as priests. Is there a real crisis of vocations going on there?
I don't believe there is, Philippa. The question of married priests is one that always occurs in England because, of course, of the Church of England, and also because, of course, the late Holy Father's generosity in allowing married ex-Anglican priest to be ordained into the Catholic Church. So the question is always around, and it's not something that I personally believe in. I really think that celibacy is the way for the Catholic priesthood in the Latin Rite. I myself am a religious Dominican, and I can see how celibacy is so important, not just in practical reasons, but practical reasons. One doesn't have to worry too much about a family and so on. You have to worry about people as close as that. But also for deep spiritual reasons, as we, in our priesthood, we draw close to Christ, and it's a particular way of following Christ. It would be very hard, I think, for married men to be ordained as priests and to live their lives as priests in the Latin Rite of the Catholic Church.
Do you have many people training in the seminaries at the moment, or is there something of a crisis, though?
I've got five young men at the moment preparing for priesthood, and I have eight in a preparation group. I had two ordinations this year. So although numbers are reducing, we still have many priests. At the moment, I have, including religious, I probably have 100 active priests in the diocese for a Catholic community of 145,000, of whom 25% would go to church on any Sunday. So I don't think people are being deprived of leadership, of their Catholic community, or perhaps most importantly of all, of the Eucharist. There are many places in the developing countries where 35,000 mass goers would be attended to by both one or two priests.
Going back to the pastoral letter, you're encouraging people, aren't you, to draw strength from 2,000 years of their Christian tradition, which, as you remind them, all started in a situation of great poverty and hardship in a stable in Bethlehem.
That's right. I thought that, particularly in St. Paul's position, where he's writing to the Philippians, and he's encouraging people to rejoice, and yet he himself is in prison when he's writing that letter. Rejoice in the Lord always, he says. And I think that this economic downturn will help people reassess the true values in their life and treasure the gifts which are not material and you can't put a price on them, such as their faith, such as their family values, and the above all maybe the question of life.
Thanks there to Bishop Malcolm McMahon of the Diocese of Nottingham in the United Kingdom. Meanwhile, over in the United States, several hundred Catholics gathered in the southern U.S. city of Huntsville, Texas, recently for a day of prayer and reflection on the dignity of human life. The event, led by Cardinal Daniel DiNardo, began in the city center near an abortion referral center and ended about a mile away close to the execution chamber of the Huntsville prison. Unlike many other pro-life demonstrations, on this occasion there were no signs or slogans or shouted protests, and the organisers were at pains to point out that this was not about party politics, but simply a day to pray and promote the value of human life at all stages and in all different conditions. Among those taking part in this pilgrimage was one of our regular guests on Vatican Radio. Dale Resinella is a Catholic lay chaplain on Florida's death row and a well-known campaigner against the use of the death penalty in the United States.
Yes, the Pilgrimage for Life in Huntsville, Texas was truly a very beautiful and holy event. The reason it's not described as a protest or a demonstration is that it was very clear that the intent of the organizers and of Cardinal Daniel DiNardo, who was the principal episcopal representative there was also Bishop Van and Bishop Gantu, he was very clear that this was intended to be an intense experience of intercessory prayer on the sanctity and holiness of human life from conception until natural death, and that it was not intended to be any way a political demonstration, and that it was not intended to engage with people through discussion or placards or pins. And so we had hundreds of people who together began with Mass, celebrated by Cardinal DiNardo, by the bishops, by about a dozen priests and over a dozen deacons. The attendance at St. Thomas the Apostle Parish in Huntsville, Texas, was so large that the church proper was full, the overflow room in the church hall was full, and two tents outside that had been set up with speakers so that people could participate from outside were completely full. As far as the people who were attending, it was marvelous. African American, Native American, and folks of European ancestry like myself, quite clearly a very broad spectrum of age, of different parts of society, and different ethnic backgrounds, all participating in a prayerful and very reverent procession celebrating the holiness and sanctity of human life.
Now, Dale, you say this was not at all about party politics, and yet it's true to say there's great concern, isn't there, in the Catholic world about these life issues and how they will play out under the next administration of President-elect Barack Obama.
Yes, there is great concern, and there has been concern over the last years at how some of the life issues have played out even under the Republican administration. When I say it's not political, it wasn't a march with placards or posters or chants, but it clearly was a statement. It was a profound statement. The words of the cardinal were a witness. So the voice of the Catholics participating in this prayerful procession, pilgrimage, were raised in prayer and in holy song, but it was a witness, a statement, a testimony that we are standing for life. Now, there are concerns, especially with the Freedom of Choice Act, that a democratically controlled Congress and a democratic administration could move forward on trying to make abortion not just more easily available, not just more easily available in later trimesters, but that it could even try under the Freedom of Choice Act to coerce participation by taxpayers in funding abortion and try to coerce participation by church institutions such as hospitals. These issues are being raised directly as political issues, and the church is being very vigilant to try and safeguard the freedom to refuse to practice abortion at church facilities, church hospitals, church medical facilities, if this Freedom of Choice Act moves forward as has been promised by the newly elected administration. So yes, you're correct. These issues are on the front burner. The Pilgrimage for Life was a very broad and moving witness of the Church's stance for life and against all the culture of death attacks, including abortion, including the death penalty, and including the attacks on the care for the aged and the infirm and the disabled.
This attitude towards all the life issues has been called the seamless garment, hasn't it? An attempt to focus not just on the issue, perhaps, of abortion, which receives so much attention in the political picture in the United States, but also to include the critical question of the death penalty. Are you hopeful that there may be changes on the horizon in the coming months under the new administration?
We are always hopeful, Philippa. And there are reasons to believe that even if the death penalty will not be abolished outright under the new administration, that there will be severe curtailments in many of the injustices that have been so pervasive over the past years. There is hope that new requirements at a federal level for hearing evidence of innocence may be possible, and that this will force the states to deal with the horrendous issues of people who are innocent, even cases like the fellow who is awaiting execution in Florida right now, a Native American, where it came to light that the state literally bought perjured testimony in his case. And yet, because of these arbitrary procedural time limits, the Florida Supreme Court felt they had no choice but to go forward and allow his execution. Justice Harry Anstead, who is a Catholic on the Florida Supreme Court, refused to go along with the majority, saying this is absolutely outrageous. This is a bombshell disclosure. How could anyone say that the jury would not have been affected by finding out that the state may have engaged in basically witness tampering? And even so, 6-1, the Florida Supreme Court felt they had no choice but to allow this execution to go forward. These kind of things, we are hoping, will, under the new administration, be preempted by new federal legislation that will go much further in requiring full hearings on those who have evidence of innocence, even at a late date.
It was perhaps particularly appropriate that this Pilgrimage for Life was taking place in Texas, with the highest number of executions, I believe, anywhere in the United States.
There's no doubt about it. Texas is the heart of the beast when it comes to the use of the death penalty in the United States. As we speak, we have had 1,129 executions in the United States since we restarted the death penalty in 1976. That doesn't include three at the federal level. Texas has done 422 of those, almost 40%. And Houston, the county that Houston, Texas resides in, has itself sent more people to execution than any state in the United States. So Texas is the center of this. But the Pilgrimage for Life, although it ended at the Walls unit in Texas there in Huntsville, where the executions take place, it began at the Planned Parenthood office about a mile from there, which is where people are referred out for abortions. And so this drew a dramatic connection that both these practices are part of the culture of death, which we must stand against in Texas and throughout the United States.
Thanks there to Dale Resinella, Catholic lay chaplain on Florida's death row and a well-known anti-death penalty campaigner in the United States. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Don't forget you can find all our news and feature programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.